Iowa history is rich and fascinating, but a lot of Iowans don't know very much about it. Historian Tom Moraine wants to change that, and he thinks he's found a way. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Iowa History 101 is a free 7-part online Iowa history series designed by Tom Moraine in partnership with the Des Moines Register and DMACC. I'll talk with him about this massive open online course, and Elizabeth Dinchel from the Herbert Hoover Presidential Museum and Katie Swalwell of Iowa State University will join the conversation to talk about their efforts to bring history to life outside of the classroom. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. The phrase Iowa history might rocket you back to fifth grade. And the truth is that the subject matter of elementary school history classes is about all that many Iowans learn about Iowa history. And we're not quite sure how much of that is retained. Historian Tom Moraine of Graceland University in Lamoni wants to change that. And Iowa History 101 is his latest effort. It's a free 7-part online Iowa history series designed by Tom Moraine in partnership with the Des Moines Register, Graceland University, and DMACC. And Tom is here with us today. Hello, Tom.
Good morning.
Oh, thank you so much for being here today.
My pleasure.
Tell me how you first got the idea for this course.
It sort of had two streams. One, I was reading about MOOCs, mass online courses. That's right. And they simply open the world of education to anyone, anywhere who has a computer. I think there was a Stanford course that was teaching artificial intelligence to 150,000 people at once. And they said, well, 90% of those people drop out. Well, that leaves 15,000 who finish the course. I think that's pretty good. So the delivery system is there. And the other one is that my brother Rick and I had the opportunity to teach an online Iowa history course to any student registered at an Iowa private college. So we had a couple sections of an online Iowa history course, developed a curriculum and taught it online. So we had the delivery system, we had the content. Why not find some way to get that out and partnered with the Des Moines Register? I do need to add that Humanities Iowa is a funding source and a partner in the project, as well as DMACC and Graceland and the Register.
All right. Well, Tom, you have dedicated a lot of your career to learning about history and to teaching history. What is the need that you see that has inspired you to keep coming up with ways to bring Iowa history to the general public?
Well, let's start with where it starts. And it's my passion to do public history. I love the challenge of taking good history and trying to find a format that reaches people, that connects it with people. That's where it started for me. I just wanted to do it. But there is a need, and one of the responses I get most Iowa historians get when they get to engage with the public is there is a deep sense of pride in Iowa that is somewhat layered with our hesitancy to brag about being Iowans. If we were in Texas, it would be no problem whatsoever. But Iowans tend to think, well, I don't know what's the matter with me, but I tend to like it here. We have this sense that Iowa is a great place to come from, but if you're going to do something significant, you need to go somewhere else. I think that's the message covertly we got through the 50s, 60s, 70s when I was growing up, that famous people don't do things in Iowa. They do it in Washington or New York or California, but Iowa is a great place to be from, and I just think that's wrong.
Well, and Tom, I Of course, I really enjoy Iowa history. I've read books that you've written about Iowa history. When I Google something about Iowa history, I often end up on the Pathways site for Iowa Public Television, and the majority of the articles on that site were written by you. I mean, Tom, this has been a lifelong mission for you to make sure that you get this information out there. Do you feel like you haven't done enough?
Well, I don't think you ever feel you've done enough. Again, I turn it around. I see that as a wonderful opportunity to do more. I love to keep doing it. So I hope we don't get the public saying, yeah, that's been great. We've had enough of you now. Let's try something else. I think there are always new people coming along. Children, students who need the education, and we certainly haven't penetrated the school system adequately, in my opinion, for Iowa history. I think local history, where you can see it, is the great way to introduce students to the idea that you don't understand the world rationally. Nobody sat and thought it up in one pattern, you understand the world historically and how it developed over time. And I think working with that is a very exciting concept.
Now, Kyle Munson rolled out Iowa History 101 in the Des Moines Register over the weekend and kind of gave everybody an introductory course. The first lesson is up there. Tell us what we can expect over the next few months.
I think public history is not necessarily the place to do heavy content, to do facts. I think public history, when people are casual about coming in and out, they're sitting down in a chair at the end of the day, they're clicking on their computers, they want something that is interesting. So the questions that we have framed for the topics are questions that anyone could be interested in. Number one, how did Iowa get its Hawkeye nickname? We talk about Iowa, the Hawkeye State. Why are we the Hawkeye State? The next one that's coming up is, how did we get our borders? We look at the map and we just assume God created Iowa in the shape that we know it now. It's not true. There was a real political battle, and we have some heroes in our history who fought hard to get the border extended to the Mississippi or to the Missouri River and to get our border pushed up north. We could have been a far different state, a very much smaller state, if there hadn't been some people around here who said, no, we want to go to the Missouri River. And I think that story is exciting.
Now, Tom, we'll talk more about some of the other stories that you'll be focusing on during the course. Was it difficult to decide what period of Iowa history you were going to focus the entire course on? Because there certainly is a theme here.
Yeah, and I think Kyle Munson deserves some credit on this one. My original concept is that we would do it like an academic course, and we would do a survey starting from early American settlement and going up through the present. He wisely suggested, let's take a particular period and maybe focus on that, and suggested the frontier period. That was a suggestion also that came from Chris Rossi of Humanities Iowa. Let's take a particular period and not try to do a whole survey. Well, the frontier period seemed like the logical place to start. And there's a lot of interesting material about early settlement and decisions that were made early on that have had tremendous and long-lasting impact to us, even to the point now that we just can't imagine that it could have been any other way. Like, what other shape could Iowa be besides what it is? That was a very fluid question at one time.
You know, Tom, it strikes me that a lot of the history that has been written about Iowa during the frontier years is older history. I mean, this is something that was covered years ago, and maybe a lot of historians didn't think that they needed to go further with it. Looking at this period in 2015, are there new perspectives, new ideas that we're able to bring to this history now?
I think if I had one wish of what people got out of the course, it is that the present is fluid, and the past was fluid when it was present, that decisions were being made that would have long-reaching implications. And I think it's not the particulars that really interest me as much as the concepts of society is fluid. The decisions we make have long-term implications. You're asking about particulars for the period that still have implications. Yeah, there are. No one's going to come up when we talk about economic development. The government, the federal government, gave 1/9 of the state, gave it away to private corporations in the form of railroad companies in order to get railroads built. We have an ongoing debate. What should the role of government be in private economic development? But there was a lot of land that was given to private corporations with very little expectation of them, except to say, if you build railroads, that's good for everybody. And I'm not arguing one way or the other, but we certainly have that question in front of us now.
Well, and I know that part of this course is that you really want to engage the people who are reading these articles and watching the videos and get them participating in the comments section. You kicked that off with the first article when talking about why Iowa's called the Hawkeye State, with asking people what other nicknames might Iowa have. Are you getting a lot of responses from people?
So far, the ones we've gotten is I can't think of anything else. We're so focused on Iowa as Hawkeyes. How could it be anything else? Well, think about what we think we're known for now. What about Iowa bikers with Ragbri being so good? The Iowa caucus goers, the Iowa Jell-O eaters. I don't know. Just open your mind, and we have 3 million people in this state. We ought to have some creativity. Not that we have to change it, but it was an option. We had choices. What would our choices be today? That's what I think is exciting.
Well, and of course, we'd love to hear from you also this hour with your questions about Iowa history, and also if you have a suggestion for a nickname for the state of Iowa. Tom, we just got this email from David in Waukee, and I can't endorse this email, but he says, I read the article by Lord Richard Acton on how Iowa became the Hawkeye State and found it very informative. Thank goodness we didn't get nicknamed the Cyclone State. Again, no endorsement here, but we are going to.
But I think the impetus to get Iowa named the Hawkeye State, and I know I'm jumping into the article, was that other states were getting horrible nicknames.
Right. It was preemptive action. We'll talk more about that in just a moment. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back. I'm talking with historian Tom Moraine of Graceland University. He is the man behind the new program, Iowa History 101, a free 7-part online Iowa History series in partnership with the Des Moines Register, Graceland University, DMAC, and Humanities Iowa. We'll continue this conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about the new Iowa history course, Iowa History 101. Historian Tom Moraine of Graceland University in Lamoni is here today. And this course is being done in partnership with the Des Moines Register, Graceland University, DMAC, and Humanities Iowa. And we were talking just a moment ago, Tom, you gave us a little bit of a preview of Lesson 1, which has already been out there, but it's about why Iowa is called the Hawkeye State. And that was a question that a lot of people couldn't find an answer to. And then Lord Richard Acton decided he would do the research and find the answer. But I do love the fact that it was sort of a preemptive measure, that all these other states were getting terrible nicknames, and somebody decided that Iowa needed a better one.
That's right. A lawyer in Burlington, David Rohrer, decided that if we don't put out one on our own, we're going to get tabbed by somebody else. There were so many people moving from Missouri to Illinois that they were Illinois was referring to the new arrivals as the Missouri suckers. Now, whether they were being sucked into Illinois or they were referred to as the little stems coming out of a tomato plant at the corner, at the elbow, that were not productive, or that they were the fish that you used as bait for something else, it was not a flattering nickname.
No.
But the worst one, though, was referring to Missouri people as Missouri pukes. I got that first one wrong. The Missouri was calling Illinois the suckers.
Okay.
And Illinois was calling Missouri the Missouri pukes because there were so many coming up. They were referring to Missouri puking people into Illinois.
Oh my!
So it was. Let's get out there and get one that we like. So it was a PR campaign, and I think that's wonderful. They just started using the term as many ways as they could and getting it out there, and everyone else assumed everyone else was calling them Iowa Hawkeyes, and that's how we got it.
Well, and is it all right if we reveal where it came from, Tom?
Oh, sure.
All right. So it was inspired by the book The Last of the Mohicans, right?
Yeah. James Fenimore Cooper was a very popular American author at the time, and his Leather Stocking Tales had a hero who was Hawkeye, a very incredible marksman who could do things with guns that no one has ever done before or since. But then also...
And he didn't live in Iowa.
No, he didn't, but the novels were. It would be like calling us James Bond people
right
now, something along those lines.
The 007 state.
That's right. That'd be good. But also it had the resonance of Black Hawk. We had just fought the Black Hawk War. Black Hawk was a popular character. He was seen as a hero of his people at the time, trying to defend the land. They weren't about to give it back, but they looked with respect on Black Hawk. So we got the Black Hawk and the Hawkeye combination, and it resonated with the people of Iowa.
Interesting. Well, I'm talking with Tom Moraine of Graceland University, and I want to bring now Elizabeth Dinchel into the conversation. She is Education Specialist with the National Archives and Records Administration and the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum. Hello, Elizabeth.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And I know you work with a lot of students around the state. You work with the public a lot, and I also know that History Day, National History Day, is something that you are extremely involved in. And when we were talking about Tom wanting history to be more relevant to people and people putting their historical research into action, I immediately thought of you because that's something that's extremely important to you. And I'm curious, I mean, history for a lot of people is something you read about. Maybe you watch a documentary. Why do you think it's something that we need to pay more attention to and really put it into action in our lives?
Well, history is unique in that it's the only subject we teach at school where we don't teach kids how to do history. In English, they read and write. In math, they solve problems. In science, they do science projects or experiments. But in history, we make them memorize things. And so we've misrepresented the field of history from the time our children are very young. So when we get to something like National History Day, we give children the opportunity to delve into archives, into records, into journalism, and start analyzing and synthesizing primary sources and making conclusions. But one of the biggest gifts we give to them doing that is increasing their literacy and their communication skills and their ability to form arguments, which we don't typically teach in history classrooms. And we also rob our students of the ability to have history all the way through school. Most schools across the country only require history for 3 years in high school. And even then, it's not entirely history. There's a year where it's government and economics. They can substitute out with different types of history, world history or religion. It kind of encompasses all of social studies and disregards history in some ways. So they don't get the opportunity to learn local history in high school. And that's where National History Day really comes into play. One of the things that we encourage, even at the national level, is that students take a local approach to it. It puts them in archives, in contact with local historians and archivists. It gives them access to mentors. And at the end of the day, the judges will probably learn something they didn't already know coming into the contest.
Well, and for people who aren't familiar with National History Day, you talk about synthesizing all of this information and the judges. What are some of the ways that students compete in History Day? What are some of the projects that they do?
Sure. Well, National History Day is a year-long contest. They start at the beginning of the year. We just had our National History Day statewide kickoff in Des Moines last week. And the students will start off, they have very specific things they will be judged on. Writing a thesis statement and supporting it with evidence is one of the big parts of the project. They have to write a process paper explaining where they did their research, how they got their sources, and every student will write an annotated bibliography. So they have to write in their bibliography why the source was important to the completion of their project. And they also have to identify if they're primary or secondary sources. And in that annotation, they typically say why they identified it that way. Sometimes sources like newspapers could be primary or secondary, or oral history interviews. But they spend the year working on the project. They attend first a local competition, and if they place in the top category or the top levels, they'll go on to state and national contests, same roles. But they get the opportunity to take their judge cards, see what they did wrong, and then revise their projects to make them better. So they'll be working with archivists, historians, and teachers all throughout the year on this one really big project.
In your work at the Hoover Library and Museum, you have said that the majority of young people that visit the museum are fourth graders. Do you find that in our school system today, is that sort of the moment in time that we focus on history and Iowa history, and then after that, not so much?
Yeah, well, and that's in the Iowa core, and that is actually kind of derived from the national standards where students are getting state and local history in fourth and sometimes in fifth grade. And it's kind of melded together with the idea of learning about neighborhoods, communities, and so we'll just throw local history in there with that. But then they move on to American studies, American history, religion, economics, politics, and local history kind of falls out of view. And like Tom was saying, I think that's where we kind of develop this mentality that where we come from isn't good enough because we get it in fourth grade, and so we learn to be proud of our community. And then moving forward, we're looking at larger national accomplishments that come from anywhere but where we're from. And I don't think that's unique to Iowa. I came from Florida, and that was a problem there as well. Students couldn't identify success with coming from where they were from. And I think that's because we have that gap in learning about our local and state history. And like he was saying, even when we get to public history, in order to engage the public, it has to be not content heavy, something they enjoy. We're all competing for time. So what's going to get somebody out of their house and away from their other activities to spend a day online on a MOOC course or in our museum learning? So, you know, we try to engage with speakers, authors, especially people, you know, that are somewhat famous that they can relate to, they've read about or seen about. But it's hard. We compete with the internet, too. People get all their information from Google now.
And Wikipedia.
So what's the point in going into a museum or enrolling in a MOOC course when you could just look it up? You know, some of the flaw in that is that our structured databases are not connected to Google. So you're not going to get hits from the National Archives or the Smithsonian when you Google something. You're going to get articles and blogs and things that might not be dependable, Wikipedia, where people can enter anything. And we tell our national history students to not use that in their bibliographies. So, I think we have a long way to go with public education and figuring out how to engage the public.
And with History Day, what students are you connecting with there? Is this something that is an extracurricular activity? Are there social studies teachers that are driving their whole classes toward this? What kind of variety of students?
So we do. We get students who will sign up in like an after-school kind of program, and they have a teacher that helps them. They sign up at the beginning of the year. And then we have some schools where the teachers make all of the students do a National History Day project. We mentor, me personally, I mentor a school in Missouri and another school in California, and I've worked with students as far away as Korea and China on their History Day projects. So it's attracting all kinds of students. But Iowa specifically has an incredibly strong delegation. There is a lot of support for National History Day students, and we always have students winning at the national contest and even advancing to the finals at nationals. You'll hear over and over, I was there this year, and it was a phenomenal feeling to hear them say, Iowa, 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 this student from Iowa, and watching the Iowa kids just really be excited. The State Historical Society in Des Moines does a great job making this a great contest in Iowa.
And Tom, as you're listening to Elizabeth talk about connecting with students in that way, I'm sure that's exciting to you. But also, you know, thinking about I know that you worked at the State Historical Society for many years, the State Historical Museum. And, you know, Elizabeth was saying that she gets a lot of fourth graders in. You get a lot of senior citizens in as well. I mean, Tom, is that a gap that you also witnessed where we have elementary school students and then people in their retirement, and they're the people who are seeking out information about Iowa history?
The Historical Society has many different branches. Archives and the library get used by serious researchers. They get used by genealogists, people coming. The museum, though, I think attracts up and down the line, and we may use the internet a lot for quick information, but there is still something about having contact with the real thing, to see that uniform that a Civil War soldier wore. That has an emotional element that reading about it does not. I think there is an appeal to many people to have contact with the real thing, and I think that's where museums still have a very incredible role to play, but also to turning on people or turning on local artifacts and local buildings and local scenes and telling about their historical significance turns it on in a way that is very hard to do digitally. I can give a quick example of that.
Sure.
When my wife and I were in Iowa City, we went to a slide lecture on 19th century architecture in Iowa City and the storefronts of downtown Iowa City. We walked past those every day, and we never looked up at the second floors to see the incredible treatments of windows, the structure of the building, how they were held together. We got a slide lecture that talked about those, and ever after, when we walked through Iowa City, we were in danger of being killed because we were out in the street looking up at the second floors to see these things and to learn that some of them had 3 and 4 basement deep where they were storing kegs of beer if it was a brewery. I think sometimes it's just that connection to say, here's a whole topic you haven't even thought about. That's what I think public history can do. You don't have to give the whole ball of wax. You have to say, this is exciting, go explore it. And I think that's where a one-shot, well-done public history course can turn them on, as opposed to feed them to satiety that they never want to hear it again.
Right. Really change your perspective forever. Yeah. I want to get to the phones. Jim is on the line in Spencer. Hi, Jim.
Hi.
Hi. What's your question?
Oh, a couple little things. I was disappointed to see that Kansas claims to have sent the most per capita Union soldiers to the war, which you can't do much about that. And I do spend a lot of time researching Iowa lately, and I will tell you that there's just as much misinformation can be had in the history books and some of the other sources that are out there. You have to do a lot of digging and really look for the truth. Of course, you know, the internet has just made, you know, researching an amazingly simple thing for us today. And I'm kind of curious to know if you have any way of ascertaining how Iowa did when it comes to the Native American treaties as compared with the rest of the nation.
Tom?
Our record isn't good there in terms of I think what 21st century standards would be in terms of fairness. The treaty with the Meskwaki and Sac Indians was of questionable authenticity in that we were not dealing probably with the whole tribe. We were dealing with a few people who did not represent the tribe, but the American government took that as justification for eventually resettlement of the Indians elsewhere. I don't know how to answer in comparison with whatever else. Look up the Treaty of 1804 with the Meskwaki and Sac. I think that's was sort of the biggie in Iowa history, and it has been challenged by historians and legal scholars as somewhat questionable. On your reference, though, to Kansas, remember there weren't very many people in Kansas at the time of the Civil War. If that's any consolation. And they had the Civil War had already been going on in Kansas for about five years before Fort Sumter came into the effect. So I'm not sure Kansas is a good comparison with other states.
All right, so Iowa can still claim its place there, you think, Tom?
There is question that we had the highest per capita enrollment. I know that's one of the things that's out there. Robert Dykstra, in his book on the bright radical star, questions that Iowa had the highest per capita.
Well, let's return to that subject in just a moment. I'm talking with Tom Moraine of Graceland University and Elizabeth Dinchel of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about Iowa history, and this conversation inspired by a new public course called Iowa History 101. It's a free 7-part online Iowa history series designed by Tom Moraine of Graceland University and developed in partnership with Graceland University, the Des Moines Register, DMAC, and Humanities Iowa. Just rolled out over the weekend on the Des Moines Register site, and Kyle Munson wrote an article about it. Tom Moraine is here with me today. Also, Elizabeth Dinchel, education specialist with the National Archives and Records Administration and the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum. And now I want to bring Katie Swalwell into the conversation as well. She's an assistant professor in the School of Education at Iowa State University in Ames, of course. And I spoke with her earlier this year because she had an open online course available to people over the summer about Iowa history, adventures in Iowa history. And the focus was Iowans and the civil rights movement. Katie, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Oh, wonderful. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you. You're welcome.
And now, while Tom has designed a course that's being rolled out in the Des Moines Register, and of course, anybody can access this online, over the summer, you had people all over the state of Iowa and perhaps elsewhere also participating in an online course through Iowa State University. You made this available to the public at no cost. How did it go? How many people did you have participating?
It went great. It really far exceeded my expectations, and we had such tremendously positive feedback at the end of the summer. So we had about 200 people register for the class, and about 150 of those were community members taking the class for free. Another 45 were teachers taking the class for a licensure renewal credit, and then another few were graduate students at Iowa State. So it was a really neat mix of people. It was really really wonderful.
And with that course, you were hoping to focus on again, I mean, we've talked about a lack of knowledge about Iowa history, but in particular, Iowans and the civil rights movement is something that not a lot of people know a whole lot about.
Yeah, I think, you know, there are lots of different ways you can think about how to present history. And I love what your other guests have talked about today. Instead of a chronological view or taking one era, what was really most interesting to me was trying to understand a theme throughout Iowa's history. So looking at current events that were happening today, really thinking about the state of racism and looking at ongoing civil rights struggles and trying to understand and unpack where those came from and what's happened in our state. And some of those stories are really really wonderful, and we should have a lot of pride in those stories, and others are really difficult and hard to learn about. But we took a more thematic approach to looking at the histories of struggles for racial justice from the frontier period all the way up until modern day. So, you know, thinking about, for example, in Tom's class, the frontier period, one of the stories that surprised me the most was learning about early debates in state conventions in the 1840s about how Iowa would be a free state. It wouldn't have slavery legalized in the state, although there were some enslaved people living in Iowa. But the debate didn't stop there. It continued, how can we make it so that African-American people won't live here? So on the one hand, it was a free state, but that there were delegates to conventions trying to construct ways to make it an unwelcome place for free Black people. So Black codes got established, very similar to many other states, that outlawed interracial marriage, prevented Black people from attending schools. There was a special tax they had to pay. So those kinds of stories, I think, are really illuminating when you're trying to understand a larger theme in either U.S. history or local history.
Well, and Tom, I know that actually that dovetails with one of the segments of Iowa History 101, which is what was the experience of early immigrants to Iowa? And you're planning to take an unvarnished look at that as well?
The chapter or the article on that is going to be from Dorothy Schweder's textbook on 19th century immigration, which she has a major section on African Americans primarily moving from the South after the Civil War, although there, as Katie points out, there were some here, despite often a hostile culture. But it also looks at Northern Europe immigration. Ireland, Germany. Germany sent the most immigrants of any European country. And of course, that's such a topical, hot topic now. But 19th century, we were actively recruiting immigrants to come. The railroads published guides to Iowa immigration in different languages in Europe and distributed those, come to Iowa. One of the things they said is, we have such a great climate. Suppose if it sells.
Well, we grow things well here.
That's right. But it did look like a wonderful place to come from Europe at the time, and we got a lot of Northern European immigrants. Later in the 19th century, that shifted to Southern Eastern Europe, and they were not coming to farm as much as to work in coal mines, to work in factories. And that created some cultural tensions with the older line immigrants. So we've had those culture battles, ethnic battles going on for a long time.
Well, and I want to ask you about this because Jim and Spencer brought up the question earlier about Native American treaties in the state of Iowa. And we do tend to, we have a lot of Iowa pride in this state, and a lot of very progressive things have happened in the history of Iowa, and a lot of us like to congratulate ourselves on being from such a progressive place. But, you know, Katie, as you pointed out, it wasn't exactly a paradise. Tom, it wasn't a paradise for everyone. Again, looking at history from 2015, is it really important to make sure that we are not just celebrating, but looking at some of the more problematic parts of our history as well? Tom?
Oh, I absolutely. And I think we should try to avoid labels that we were good or we were bad. We were complex. And one of the things that's great about History Day, when students get into it, they discover the complexity of history, of different views, of different impact of people. Western migration is one way to put it. Native American displacement is the flip side of that coin, and which you want to pick up. And we tend to, I think, sometimes flatten the complexity so it's easier to teach, and that's a mistake.
And Elizabeth, I see you nodding your head. Would you like to weigh in on this one too?
Oh, I mean, I agree entirely. And one of the things that we have to work with our students is looking at those complexities because it's not something they've been exposed to before. Just like you alluded to, we flatten it out so that we can teach it, but we also split it up. So we would teach all of these great things about our history in one segment, and then maybe a whole nother chapter is dedicated to what we did to Native Americans, and then we'll get back on track with, you know, moving on in the timeline. And so I think we do it a disservice by flattening it out, by separating it, and not showing that there was converging ideas and very complex issues that went into the decision making and even how we present it now.
And Katie, did you want to add anything on that subject as well?
Yeah, I think that the idea of, you know, history getting flattened, it's something that teachers struggle with. And it's something I thought a lot about in constructing this course, too. You know, you want to engage people and it's July and it's beautiful out and people are busy and, you know, you don't want to overwhelm them. But these issues, you know, for people that are really curious about learning how history connects to today and continues to have reverberations through our lives today, that it really does ask people to be willing to keep an open mind and sit with some nuance and sit with complexity. And, you know, I really trust that people like that. They like their brains hurting when they're learning about history. So, you know, it is tricky to do in sort of this, you know, attention span era where we have maybe 15 seconds where we look at something and then can get distracted. But I have to say, I was really impressed with people this summer that they were very willing to dig in and to grapple with some really, really difficult questions.
Let me jump in on that one, too, because I think it's an important point. One of the nice things, one of the advantages of history is that you can discuss complexity in a relatively safe space sometimes, that you can get away from the emotionalism of the interest of the issues in the present, and you can look at it 100 years ago and say, this is how people were seeing it 100 years ago. And you can then you can move around in the issue without the emotionally charged divisiveness that we seem to have in American politics today, where someone says my vision of history is correct, or someone else says my vision of this issue is the only one that we can talk about. But history gives you a safe space, or a relatively safe space, where you can talk about the way different people viewed it without that emotional layer that we sometimes get in politics.
Well, and Tom, that for me, that makes a strong argument for spending time studying history as you grow older. I think about fourth and fifth graders. And of course, the moral code at that point in one's life is a little more black and white. And it's sometimes difficult to look at what happened to Native Americans and understand how people who, let's say they were your ancestors, were able to do this. Is that part of an argument for making sure that this is something we return to again and again?
Well, I think, again, I'd defer to the History Day people, and I've been a History Day judge, and I love it. It's amazing how students can deal with different perspectives. Fairly young students can see how different people experience things, all within the same exhibit, and I think we shortchange them if we say they can only be given a sanitized version. I don't think that's true, and I think sometimes we need to raise the bar on the expectation.
Elizabeth?
Yeah. Well, absolutely. One of the things that I teach in my professional developments to teachers is that content is grade level neutral. We can put any content in front of students as long as we present it at their level, and let's challenge them to exceed our expectations. There's a new format for writing lesson plans called the C3 format that's coming out, and we pose questions to the students and give them the ability to work with primary sources and answer those questions. So they're always in a position to exceed what we expect from them. And I would say, by and large, they absolutely do. They get it. Something clicks. They get passionate about what they're learning about. They can answer really complex questions. They have debates with each other. They make connections to the present. And I think we are shortchanging our students by putting multiple choice tests in front of them.
I loved an example where I was teaching an Iowa history course to high school students, and one of the students finally made the connection why there are Farleys and O'Malleys and Rileys in his local cemetery, and connected it to the potato famine in Ireland. And it was this light bulb went on. History happened here. We have history in our cemetery. And it was just wonderful to the excitement that he got that there was something about history in his hometown. And I think sometimes we just assume they aren't going to make that connection. But I like that. You put the content in front of them, and they can do it.
Yeah.
Tom, before we run out of time for this hour, I want to mention that a lot of the material in Iowa History 101 is inspired by Dorothy Schweder, a late historian who, of course, worked at Iowa State University for many, many years and has written many books. And you also dedicate the course to Dorothy.
Yep.
So I know she was a partner of yours in exploring Iowa history and in writing about Iowa history. Was this a plan that you ever talked about with her?
Yes. We reserve Friday afternoons for debriefing, come back to earth. We would tell about our public history experiences and share with each other. But she was a public historian par excellence and teaching Iowa history and enjoying it. But one of the things I so admired about Dorothy during the civil rights movement of the 1960s and 70s, she would take ordinary people and show the significance of their lives. And historians were not doing that. But she could take a coal miner's wife or a farm wife or an immigrant of any kind and put them in a larger context and make them important historically. I think one of the shames of Iowa, if we're going to talk about it, she retired in 2001, and there is not a single tenure-track Iowa history professorship at any of the region's institutions. We have not created a tenure-track line that specializes in Iowa history since Dorothy had one in 2001. It's been taught occasionally, but it's been by adjuncts who are not there or given research time. And if anything, I will beat the drum in Dorothy's honor that she was such an asset to the state that we should continue the tradition that she started.
Well, and I know you're in good company here today. And Tom, we haven't talked about all of the different parts of frontier life in Iowa History 101. You'll also be writing about pioneer farm families and what their lives were like, the role of steamboats and railroads in Iowa early days, and I mentioned the experience of early immigrants to Iowa. And then I'm guessing around December how Iowa pioneers families celebrated Christmas. But it sounds like it's going to be a wonderful, wonderful experience for a lot of people. Tom Moraine, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Historian Tom Moraine of Graceland University. He is the man behind Iowa History 101. It's a free 7-part online Iowa history series designed by Tom in partnership with the Des Moines Register, Graceland University, DMAC, and Humanities Iowa. And Katie Swalwell, we were talking earlier about your course that you taught over the summer, an open course available to the public as well. Do you have plans for another course next summer?
Yes, we're running the same class with some improvements and some tweaks and new content from July 1st. The 31st this summer. And then just today is the Iowa Council of Social Studies Conference at Perry Meadows, and I'll be presenting a crash course from the class today. So, yeah, we'll definitely have it again, and I encourage anyone who's interested to sign up.
All right. Katie Swalwell, assistant professor in the School of Education at Iowa State University. Over the summer, she taught the online course Iowans and the Civil Rights Movement. And I'm sure there'll be more to hear from her on that subject and many others in the future. Elizabeth Dinchel, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
Elizabeth Dinchel is education specialist with the National Archives and Records Administration and the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library Museum. And of course, today we were also talking a great deal about National History Day, a topic I'm sure we'll revisit in the future as well. Talk of Iowa is produced by Claire Roth, Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.